Welcome to Crosstalk Podcast. I'm Corey Rabin. I have a very, very special guest with me today, a good friend, a colleague, a fellow attorney, and a terrific poker player. No, he's not a poker player. Want to welcome my buddy, Eddie W. Eddie, welcome.
Good afternoon, Corey. How are you?
It's a beautiful afternoon. We're taping this day before Thanksgiving 2024.
Indeed.
Where'd you grow up?
So I grew up as a kid in South Brooklyn in Gravesend, Coney Island, near Coney Island. I went to the Yeshiva Flatbush growing up. We weren't religious, but pretty traditional. And I was there till I was 17 and then packed it up to college in Baltimore and then law school in Williamsburg, Virginia, and then settled back here at the ripe old age of 24 to start my practice.
Mom and dad growing up, you had both parents?
No, I didn't. My dad, my parents were of different backgrounds. My dad was Catholic. My mom was his third wife. My dad took off when I was three to marry someone else. And when I was eight, lifted off to Arizona to retire from his job in the New York Police Department and stay there permanently.
Did you have contact with him in your childhood?
Yeah, so pretty sparse. Since he left at eight, the next time I saw him was at my bar mitzvah when I was 13. And the next time, we had a couple of rounds of that that didn't go great. And then from 14 until I was just engaged, so I want to say 2009, so 31, I don't think I saw him at all. And it was just sporadic phone calls. At first somewhat because of him. And then after I was 14, mainly because of me.
When you say because of him, meaning he was just absent and even though you were trying to get a hold of him, he wasn't reachable or?
Good deposition question. No, I would say that he reached out when he felt like it, mainly by letter. That's not a great way for an eight-year-old kid trying to live a life to communicate with his dad, which is tough. But I mean, there was a lot of anger built up from that. But when I was 13, 14 and got a chance to really be around him for weeks at a time for my own choosing, I felt as if that relationship wasn't good for me. And so I cut it off.
When you say it wasn't good for you, what do you mean by that?
Well, he was in a marriage and in a relationship where I would only come to learn later, really was just driven by his spouse's need for him to be around all the time. And he was happy to capitulate to that. He was happy to be part of that. And as a kid of a single mom, I was used to being first. And I didn't want to be around all the negativity that surrounded their family. So I made a choice at 14, kicking and screaming, to stop having contact with him. I didn't do it in a healthy way because I kept all the resentment from that decision and decided instead that that would be the strong decision to do what I thought was right, as opposed to dealing with whatever as opposed to meeting him where he was. Let's look at a recovery concept. I made a decision that was about what I thought was the right thing to do because it was the right thing to do, and not a decision to meet him where he was and accept what he was willing to give and have the relationship on the terms that the world dictated rather than the terms that I wanted to dictate.
And is he still alive?
No, died in 2018.
And when he passed away, were you around? Was he around you? Did you have a chance to reconcile?
So I would call the reconciliation happened more along. I brought my wife to see him, then my fiance, and
you bore both of them.
Yeah, my wife and my fiance, exactly. It was kind of a weird situation because it taught me a lot about how much of the issue was me and how much of the issue wasn't me, like what my part was and what his part was. We came up to the door. My wife was like, "Hey, listen, he didn't know at the time that my wife had a medical condition that required her to go to the bathroom, and he didn't let her in to the house because his wife was in the house." And he's like, "You want to go inside?" "No, no, let's go somewhere else." My wife's like, "I just got off a plane like an hour ago. I need to pee." And he still wouldn't let her in. During that trip, I reconnected with my older brother from one of his prior marriages, and then with my two sisters from his prior marriage. And those two relationships have been sort of the prize from the reunion. I wouldn't call it a reconciliation, but at least it was a reconciliation for me mentally, because I just made a decision to sort of give the relationship whatever it would accept, and take back from it whatever it would accept, and not resent who he was anymore. And that was a lot better for me.
Right. It's a good rule going forward for everything, really.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the terms I'm putting on it now are recovery terms.
Right.
But I recognize that for better, mainly for better, that's what I was doing at the time. I'm able to apply those concepts now without 25 years of practice and of trial and error and banging my own head against the wall with resentments in order to accomplish those goals. But ultimately, I did get there with him.
You went to school. You're in Gravesend. You went to college and then law school. Any alcohol or drug use during this period of time, or was it a late stage thing?
Well, so you know my story, so I know you knew to ask that question. And in my mind, alcohol and drug use did not become a part of my story until I'm 46. So until I would say, and I got sober at 42. But I would say that prescription drugs became a part of my story some point in my 30s. And then alcohol slowly and really at a high arc in my mid 30s. And then during 2020 for sure spiked after I had bariatric surgery.
So talk about prescription drugs. These were drugs you got from doctors or
yeah.
the street?
Yeah, no, Xanax. It's one prescription drug and it's Xanax that I started to get in order to sleep because, you know, the way that I grew up in my job, my career, my profession, you know, you wake up in the morning and your mind is like, Corey, you put it now that it's untreated alcoholism, but really your mind just is like a maelstrom of fear of what's going to go wrong today and how it's life and death. And at some point it spills out of the morning, goes into the rest of the day. And there was a point where like I couldn't function without like a milligram or two of Xanax. At first it was just asleep, and then I couldn't function during the day without it. Like, and then it went from one to two, never got higher than four, but 4 milligrams of Xanax is a lot of Xanax.
And like when you mix the alcohol, it has a synergistic kind of effect.
In rehab, in treatment, we call Xanax freeze-dried alcohol. So it's just adding more alcohol to alcohol. But I would say that, you know, for me, as I look back on it, it was less the substance and more the thinking behind why I was using it. Like with everything else that I experience in this journey, it's my relationship with it. Like in my crazy brain, all the fears that I woke up with in the morning were real. They were how everybody purportedly lives. And none of that's true. Like they weren't meeting life on life's terms. They were meeting life on the terms of my limbic system, like my lizard brain, saying that like everything revolves around me. If I don't do something, the world will not sort it out. The end will be catastrophe. And so anyway, it was And my wife had said something at some point, like, you know, you're becoming a pill popper. And I didn't like, oh, just take a Xanax. You feel that. Okay. I feel better now. But like I was living in the asylum I created, right? Like no perspective, no balance, 100% constantly on the phone talking about work.
And you weren't hiding any of this.
No.
So when you went out drinking, it was after work or during work?
So no, I wasn't an after work drinker. If I drank, it would be like either out with friends, having cigars. Cigars are a very significant hobby of mine. I have a fantastically lovely stash that I keep at home. I'm blessed with a lot of great friends in that hobby. It would be either drinking out with them, drinking during family events, like Passover. I would get, like, I'd be asleep. But again, it was one of those things where in my brain, I would just go weeks without drinking. But as I allowed the stress and fear from work to creep in, more and more drinking happened on a more and more regular basis. And then eating got out of hand. And I ended up, it was like the time I had bariatric surgery in 2019, all bets were off. That and COVID at the same time. It was.
What year did you have the bariatric?
2019. That was like it was like one of these things where the world just unraveled for me in the span of 8 months. It was surgery in August. And then like I went crazy in my head, like something snapped in terms of like the anxiety I felt on a regular basis, like the fear and the...
It was accelerated?
It was insanely accelerated to the point where I was like, what is going on with me? And then I guess 3 months later, I found myself at the end of the day with a glass of 60% whiskey, which is not good for that surgery.
So let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Do you think the change in your food behavior after the surgery, there was a comfort you got with eating? Because if you needed bariatric surgery, you're obviously well overweight and you were a candidate for that. So by having the surgery and changing your ability to use food the same way you were using it before, you think that has some connection to why things snapped?
Yeah, I think it was that. I think also Xanax works differently after your bariatric surgery. So like, you know, I had a different leash from my brain.
Because your weight was changing and the impact was greater?
No, because my stomach was worked differently.
So chemically, you think it impacted you differently?
Chemically, I think it didn't impact me for long enough.
I see. So there was a diminished impact from it.
Yeah, it was much
more drinking.
Yeah, it was more rebound. Yep, correct. And then, you know, I was in the middle of a really intense time.
Work-wise, you mean?
Yeah, work-wise, yeah. It was one of these things where it was one of these cases where I took it really personally, and so did everybody I was working with, or at least the people whose opinions I cared about. And I just found myself to just like the anxiety and snapping started at 9 and ended at 7 and went from 7 to 7, from 7 to 9 overnight.
So your crutches weren't working as well. Mm-hmm. Work was getting doubling or tripling in intensity and stress, aggravation, et cetera. And then there came a point in 2000, I guess we're up to 2020.
Yeah, before COVID, I ran. And what I mean by ran is I went to work elsewhere. In other words, I left the asylum and I shouldn't say it's an asylum because it really is a group of very talented and fantastic lawyers, but it is not a place where anyone can coast. And, you know, I was functioning at a very high level and I decided to go clerk for a judge instead. Rear back the throttle, pursue a different passion I had, which was perhaps join the judiciary at some point. And I just pulled... I guess looking back on it, I pulled the parachute and I went to work for a judge.
And that lifestyle would be...
Right before COVID started. Sorry, Corey. Yeah.
Would be a lot more calm, an environment where you might not have the need to act out as much. But did that change your behavior in terms of Xanax or adjusting to the bariatric surgery or alcohol?
I guess like during the honeymoon period or the first 2 weeks, yeah. but then we got COVID. And aside from COVID, it didn't end up being what I thought it would be.
The job,
yeah. And, you know, I was used to functioning. Let me put this in recovery terms. When you're living your life without the gratitude of understanding where you are and how you got there and being grateful to God for the gifts that he's given you, and you run, like, you know, F everything and run from fear, and then you get to where you're going as somebody in recovery, you think in your mind that there's some sort of entitlement to all of the rewards that go with the successes that you've gotten. But the fact of the matter is that when you run someplace that you think is refuge, and you're in a refugee camp or you're in somewhere else, nobody gives a damn what you've done before. They're living their own life and they have their own thing. And if you're a drunk or an alcoholic or an addict, in your brain, the world centers around you. And so it's not enough that you bring your expertise to the table. It's not enough for you that you can operate at a high level in that environment. You have to be the center of attention all the time. And so even if you're doing the job and you're working, it's like everything else, it's never enough. And so without discussing all of the other things that were going on at the time in the job, it was certainly not the right time for me to be in that kind of role, with the crazy thinking spiking.
Did you feel more like you were a very small piece of a puzzle and that you didn't matter? Whereas in the other environment, let's call it, for borrow your word, the asylum, you were in the middle of the wheel.
Yeah, but it wasn't a status thing in my head. In my head, it was an adrenaline thing. In other words, like when you are representing clients, you are like on a football field or in an operating room. And the job is to, when the patient gets put on the table, is to fix the patient. They don't come to you and tell you what's wrong with them if they're not conscious. Sometimes they don't know what's wrong with them. Sometimes they tell you the wrong thing's wrong with them. And your job is to fix the problem. Working for the government is different. It's very focused on finishing what's in front of you, deciding what's in front of you.
And what time you're leaving?
Sometimes, although God bless her, my judge left every day at 2 a.m. So, I mean, it was more about, you know, doing the job, hitting the metrics of that work, serving a different master. And now I realize, sitting here today, like in terms of gratitude, that God, as far as a career, God put me here to fix those patients' legal problems. Like, they come in and the gift they get when they get me is they get someone that is going to focus on making their problem better. I'm not worried about me, I'm worried about them. And that part of that is recovery. Like, it's no longer like, you know, oh, you should be so grateful that, no, I'm here to help you. That's the job. And that's the job I'm here to do.
So you and I met around this time. And yep. I know that you were hospitalized.
Yep.
You talk a little bit about that experience, what preceded it,
yeah,
what was wrong, and how you came to be in a place where we met.
I remember there was a lot of resentment going back to, of course, since my career was the most important thing to me at the time, and it's still very important to me, but it's definitely not the most important thing to me anymore. It can be my higher power, but intellectually, it's definitely not my most important thing anymore. Although that might be a contradiction, and I'm sure I'll get something from my sponsor on that. But
well, we have judges in the back. We can find out if it's a contradiction or not. Let's just go to the panel. It could be. Let's just let it go.
Yeah. Well, see, that's the problem. I was carrying a lot of resentment about a lot of different things that had gone on over the year before. But I was working in a different place, and I had an evening where I guess I was getting ready to go do something. Well, actually, preceding that, a week before, I had ended up in, I drank a bottle of wine during the day, and I was drinking all the time now. But in particular, about the hospitalization, I fell over in the basement. My 8-year-old, at the time, 8 years old, found me passed out in the basement. I was later able to return the favor for my super, but he found me and carried me upstairs. And then my wife sent me to the hospital, and I was in the ER for the whole day. And then I came home. Again, this is really fuzzy, but I remember going out. My wife had left, and I remember going out, and a week later, and it was, I remember clear as day, it was Sunday night, October 24th, 2020, and I bought a bottle of Basil Hayden and drank it in an hour. And
this is after you had just returned
from week after I returned from the hospital. Yeah. I drank a bottle of Basil Hayden in an hour. And the next thing, and that was probably at about 7 o'clock at night. The next thing I remember was waking up in the emergency room, and I couldn't talk. I realized I had a tube in my throat. It was 5 a.m. I pulled it out. Like, what is in my mouth? I just pulled the damn thing out. Somebody told me, like, how did you not tear your vocal cords? Learned the first question the ER doc asked me was why I tried to kill myself. And I didn't understand the question because I hadn't, because in my mind I was Superman, right? Just whatever I did, I was going to survive. It's sort of like there are people who do live life like that professionally. It's just like, I describe it as playing Mario Brothers without jumping, just walking and not hitting any of the mushrooms and not hitting any of the ducks. And so anyway, I had a 4.5 blood alcohol, turns out, had a central line in my heart because there was some other event that went on. And then I ended up in the ICU for a week and then stepped down to regular unit like Xanax. They were giving me Xanax and all kinds of stuff to make sure I didn't have other consequences.
Seizures and
stuff. Yeah, like I guess so. Yeah. And then I came home and, you know, they always talk death, jail and institutions. Well, there's your mom's couch. That's the fourth place. It's like,
is that the worst place?
No. My mom's couch is fine. My mom's couch is fine. It's just that, as 42, you'd rather be on your own couch, but that wasn't happening given my condition. So, I called my doctor and we decided that the best thing for me was to go to treatment. Not everyone in the family agreed with that. Others believed that I should continue to work because I had a family to help support. But ultimately, a couple of very smart people in the programs told me the first axiom I learned in the program, which was anything that you put before your sobriety, you will lose. So over the objections of those who I would normally have wanted to please, just to show that if it went wrong, it was their fault, I made the best decision I could have possibly made and got up on November 2nd and 4 Xanax in me went to Karen.
With 4 Xanax?
With 4 Xanax in me, yeah. Oh, I was in the car. I think at the time, the most recent Taylor Swift album was Folklore. I was in the car singing Exile. My mother was like, that's a really depressing song. And I was like, so good.
And so when you got there, you were in detox or?
Yeah. So I was clean from alcohol for a week. But I didn't realize what the detox from Xanax was going to be like. So it was overnight, obviously. And then I told the doctor with hands shaking in front of me and thinking that was normal too, that I had to get to my unit because I had no idea what I was going to do if I had to sit in detox. Like detox is like, the rooms are like optically nicer, but there's much less to do. All you can do is like walk around the hallway and have people tell you to get back in your room. It doesn't feel like you're going anywhere. It's like the train station in the third Matrix movie. It's like you run that way and you're in the same room. You run this way and you're in the same room.
Unless it's medicine time and you know they do give you things to reduce withdrawal.
So that was a 2-week process. And then months of medication to deal with the post-acute stuff. And like at one point I forgot to take it for a couple of weeks, that like months after, and I started to like feel like a rock. I think I called you one time, like, Corey, I don't feel right. Like, I'm losing it. And then I called my doctor and he's like, did you stop taking the medicine? And sure enough, like, I took two doses and was like, oh.
Better.
Yeah, amazing. If I listen to people and don't sort of run it my way, kind of works.
It's always good to call a doctor, not a lawyer, about those things.
Yeah. So post-acute withdrawal from Xanax was definitely one of those teaching moments where you're like, yeah.
Yeah, that's one.
Even if I didn't have a program, this is a reason not to do it.
Yeah, it's the half-life is, it could be 2-3 years to really completely detox off of benzos. So it's one of the toughest ones. They told me in some of the education that I got along the way is that the only drug that you can die from in terms of withdrawal is alcohol. The others just make you really sick. But typically they don't lead to the kind of breathing or cardiac events, seizures, et cetera, that alcohol does. Doesn't mean it's a great thing. The withdrawal from Oxy for me was, miserable. I tried to do it on my own. I knew that there was such a thing as a detox to be able to make it a little easier. I would have been there a lot sooner, I think.
Well, I think like all addicts, like I thought that, it wasn't going to happen to me. And then I was chairing a AA meeting and my uncle qualified, right? Like, and my grandmother on my dad's side died of cirrhosis. So like, why wouldn't it happen to me? Right? Like, I just thought, oh, I'm on prescription drugs. I'm not really addicted. I'm just taking prescription drugs. And the doctor's saying it's okay to have more. Like, it's cool. But I mean, I learned something at Karen, which obviously was later reinforced. It seems simplistic, but it's the more like the why and the how. Like, I can lie to my doctor and say I need more Xanax. But I mean, if I take two Advil for a headache, it's fine. But if I'm popping Advil because my mind thinks that it needs Advil and or Benadryl in order to sedate myself, well, that's a different situation than taking a sip of Benadryl on your doctor's orders to go to sleep, right? It's the same thing with Xanax. Like, I guess, if I'm dealing with my problems and I take a Xanax because the doctor says it's good for you to have a Xanax today, I guess that's fine. But if it becomes a situation where I'm like manipulating to get more, not dealing with my problems, not working a program of recovery, that's a different problem. That's altogether a different situation.
I think it goes to the issue of, I think they in the big book in chapter 5, How It Works, it talks about the bar to being able to get well is if you can't be honest with yourself, then it ain't going to work.
Right. Life of rigorous honesty. That's correct.
Yeah. So you go to treatment, you go through detox. And so for people that don't know what it's like, you want to talk a little bit about your experience? Yeah, I'm not looking for a blow for 30 days, but just generally what you got out of that experience.
It's difficult to separate how I felt while I was there from what I got out of the experience. Detox and where treatment wasn't the kind of place for me where as I was there, I was like, wow, I really appreciate all the stuff that's going on around. I'm really learning stuff today. And I know the transcript of this conversation would read like I just said that, but I didn't, that I was learning stuff, but that's not how it felt. How it felt was like, me in a cage trying to like learn how to juggle inside the cage. Because I was so clueless as to how much my mind's need to control everything around me had built up this illusion that was possible. And I had this misconception that the whole world was on me and there was no one else who was going to do it, who was going to help. There was no one else invested as much as I was. I had a whole crew of people around me wanting to help me. Corey, Eric Weber, Bowtie, Christina, my counselor. And then afterwards, I mean, I can name a billion other people, but Betsy afterwards. But like for those 4 weeks and the 4 weeks after, it was like, it was like you were in jail and you were trying to like run the drug ring on the outside. Like, what can I do? Like, I had this idea that I had to check my email all the time because, like, this new job that I had just started was like, I'm for sure going to get emails. What have I never gotten emails? But now, look, obviously, looking back with program on my, in my pocket, you know, I think back to what Bowtie told me. Bowtie, for anyone who doesn't know, is one of the professional counselors at Karen. He told me something really important. And he said, because I asked him if I belong there. Because in my brain, 2 weeks in, I didn't know that I belong there. And he was just really careful to just make sure that what I got was literacy in recovery. Like, there's no proselytizing going on over there. Like, a lot of people, I think, get the impression that they're trying to inculcate you with their philosophy of recovery. That's not, in my mind, looking back, what was going on. In my mind, what I got out of that place were the tools that, with a clear head, one can apply when they start working their program of recovery. I got to understand what the consequences of a life of addiction were. And that was a really important lesson for me, because now I can identify, and this is so important for my recovery, is being able to identify when there are consequences of alcoholic behavior, not necessarily drinking.
If you had the opportunity to speak to, I'm going to pick 13, 14-year-old Eddie, knowing what you know right now, what kind of advice would you give that youngster to help him as he moved along?
I don't know. It's too much. I would want to stay around and take it day by day. That's how much help that kid needed. I might tell him that 13 and 14 could set the tone for your whole life. I might tell him that. 13 to 18 might set the tone for your whole life. What you look like, what you think like, what you feel like, for the rest of your life might just be defined in those years. And they might be hard to change. And listen more to the world around you as opposed to fighting more with the world around you. That's what I would tell them.
So, Eddie, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
For being here. I'm grateful.
Thanks for having
you
me.
Being here. So that's Crosstalk for today. And really happy that you listened in and hopefully got a lot out of our session. Thanks so much for watching. Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time.